Good morning, and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we are glad to have you with us. We're also pleased for this hour of Focus 580 to be speaking with Charles Delfer, someone who spent over 25 years in the national security agencies of the U.S. government. He's been involved in policy development, in operations, and intelligence in a number of places in the world, the Middle East, Africa, Central America, and Asia. He was also involved in the U.S. nuclear weapons and space programs. And most recently, he was the top CIA officer directing the investigation of Saddam Hussein's regime and its WMD programs. And he was, in fact, one of the most senior intelligence officials to work in Iraq, both before, during, and after the American invasion. He served as special advisor to the Director of Central Intelligence for Iraq WMD, Weapons of Mass Destruction, and he led the Iraq Survey Group that conducted the investigation into the scope of Iraq's WMD, and the final report of that group generally is known as the Delfer Report. It was issued to the President and Congress in October 2004. In the 90s, he was at the United Nations serving as the Deputy Executive Chairman and subsequently Acting Chairman of the UN Special Commission on Iraq, known often by its initials as UNSCOM. That was from 1993 until it was terminated in the year 2000. He's the author of a book that came out a few months ago, writing about his experiences. The title of his book is Hide and Seek, The Search for Truth in Iraq. Public Affairs is the publisher. So certainly, if you would like to read the book, you can find it in the bookstore or in the library. And we welcome questions from listeners. We ask that people are as brief as they can be so we can keep moving, get in as many callers as possible. And we hope people will stay focused on the topic. But of course, questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. So again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WYLL or 9455. That's the number. And we do have that toll free line. So if it would be a long distance call, calls on us, 800-222-9455. At any point, questions are welcome. Mr. Delfer, hello.
Hello.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
The very most basic, the bottom line here, and we can talk about this in different ways, but your basic conclusion is that on both sides of this conflict, on the side of the United States government over several administrations, not just the Bush administration, but over several, and on the side of Iraq during the time that Saddam Hussein was in power, both sides failed to understand the other, their motivation, their thinking. We made assumptions that were unwarranted. We made policy on that. And the result, at the end of the day, was bad decisions on both sides.
I think that's correct. I mean, it's almost, you know, Shakespearean in a sense, in the tragedies and miscalculations and misconceptions on both sides. When you try to step into the perspective of the opposing parties, and what I try to do in my book is bring the reader a little bit into the perspective of the Iraqis, because they are, you know, I knew them very well. You know, you can see how the decisions were made. They were wrong. You can see how, you know, mindsets and biases accumulated over time. And, you know, it's almost a natural human condition in a sense. People see what they want to see, and the problems will repeat themselves, sadly, you know, if we don't keep reminding of ourselves that there are other perspectives. Bringing it home to, general people's views, people who watch, you know, Fox News tend not to watch MSNBC. They see things which reinforce their you know, perceptions, and so they may not see a different perspective.
One of the things that I think is very striking is that you say that over this time that we're talking about, that very, very few people, in fact, maybe you were almost the only one who was involved in American intelligence who was actually spending time talking with people in the Iraqi government and getting some sort of sense of what they were thinking and how they were operating. And I think one of the criticisms that has been made, particularly of the Bush administration, was that the only Iraqis they were talking with were Iraqi exiles who had been out of the country for a long time and had certainly had their own agendas.
I think that's right. I think, you know, we paid an enormous price for ignorance. And one of the, you know, the faults I would put with the Bush administration is that, in that sense, they almost, you know, designed their decisions around ignorance. The intelligence community certainly had its mistakes, and we got the assessment on weapons of mass destruction wrong. The administration, however, chose to believe and use those assessments on Saddam's WMD programs. However, the intelligence community had a much better perspective, a much more accurate perspective on the internal dynamics of Iraq. In other words, you know, what was going on inside Iraq, what Iraqis inside Iraq were thinking and doing. And the administration really elected not to use and not to believe that assessment, electing, you know, by preference to use, you know, these external opposition, to use the jargon, these guys like Ahmed Chalabi, who were, you know, quite savvy in how to work Washington, but who hadn't been in Iraq in a long, long time. And that was a very costly mistake. You know, my judgment is that, you know, Iraq, you know, it did not need to be this hard. We could be where we are now in Iraq 4 years ago without the intervening costs and lives on both sides, and certainly in treasure.
Mm. Going back, and you encourage people to look back and look back over a couple of administrations, in fact, going all the way back to the time that Jimmy Carter was president, to think a little bit about how this relationship developed and some of the decisions that Saddam Hussein made. And, you know, when you do that, I think you look now at this point where we have for several years now just been consumed with Iraq. If you go back to this point, say, in the late 1970s, there was so many other things the United States was worried about. This still was the Cold War, and Iraq was just, it was almost not on our radar screen.
Well, that's correct. And, you know, from the Washington perspective, if you go back exactly as you pointed out, David, as, you know, in the late 70s, you know, the world was dominated by the United States and the Soviet Union, NATO and Warsaw Pact. Everyone in Washington involved in national security, you know, was involved in those questions, and that was where the money went. That's what the defense planning was around. The, you know, the Persian Gulf area, the Gulf, that was a, you know, that was something that, you know, I don't know, a bunch of specialists might have focused on. From Saddam's perspective, however, I mean, you know, from his, where he was, you know, Iran and all this, that was dominated. So again, I come back to this point where it's difficult for analysts, and I fault, you know, our own American intelligence analysts for not being good enough at this, but for not putting themselves into the perspective of those they're trying to understand. You know, there's an interesting point in the summer before Saddam invaded Kuwait in 1990. There was a lot of tension in the region. Saddam was feeling that his neighbors, whom he believed he defended in the previous decade during a very costly war with Iran, you know, they were not relieving his debt. They were doing things to hurt him, he felt. He called in the American ambassador, a woman named April Glaspie, in a meeting in July, and basically sounded her out on what the American position would be if he was not able to resolve his differences peacefully with Kuwait, and things, you know, went on a more warlike footing. He got a mixed message in return. Now, you know, sort of looking backwards, you can just think of how the world would have been different if the message that Saddam got in the weeks before he invaded Kuwait in 1990, if the message was, in fact, what the United States wound up doing. If Saddam had been told that if you go into Kuwait, the United States and its allies will deploy 500,000 troops, 6 aircraft carriers, wings of aircraft, if Saddam had gotten that message clearly, he would have never invaded Kuwait. And think about how the world would have been different since then. But of course, neither the United States didn't know itself what it would do then. It did not expect that he would really go into Kuwait. The United States did not understand that, because the Berlin Wall and the tensions with the Warsaw Pact, former Soviet Union, had all gone away in the previous year and a half, that it had the opportunity to stand on principle in a case that was, distant from where it had been previously focused.
Well, I think at the same time, I suppose you could understand how it is that Saddam Hussein would consider what to that date had been his relationship with the United States, the fact that the United States had supported Iraq in the Iran-Iraq war, and maybe, again, for obvious reasons, this was a case of my enemy's enemy is my friend. So we supported him, and he came to believe that we thought he was an important asset in the region. It would seem for him almost an inconceivable notion that after all of that, the United States would turn around and mobilize this international coalition to make war on him. The idea just would never have come into his head.
David, your memory is very good, and your point is spot on. From his perspective, the United States and Iraq had coincident interests. Iraq, at that time particularly, was westward-leaning. It was secular. They were great builders. They had a powerful army. From Saddam's perspective, in his analysis, and he had a very shrewd sense of power and force, he concluded that the United States and Iraq had, natural allied interests. And the previous decade, the United States had supported Iraq in its war with Iran. Remember that Iran had undergone a revolution in 1979 and had taken over the American embassy and had hostages and so on and so forth. Iraq, having miscalculated the size of the Iranian response during that war, used large numbers of chemical weapons against the Iranians, 101,000 chemical munitions during their war with Iran. The United States provided intelligence to Iraq that they used to help target these things. Now, on occasion, the United States would say, chemical weapons are bad, but if you're Saddam, the message you get is actions, and the actions were not that the United States particularly cared about his use of weapons of mass destruction. So from Saddam's perspective, he's got a decade of experience where the United States is tilting towards him, is not particularly complaining about WMD, and then yet when he invades Kuwait, he is surprised because he did not expect, nor was he told to expect, that there would be this very large, substantial response. Hmm. Don't mistake me. I don't want to sound like I'm defending Saddam. He was a truly horrible leader, and he did terrible things to his own populations. But we only had a very cartoonish image of him in Washington. He was very shrewd, very smart, and from his perspective, you can understand his logic. It was a cold, harsh logic, but you can see how he would interpret wrongly some of the message he was getting from the United States.
Yeah, and I think that here again, looking back to the Iran-Iraq War of the 80s, it's important to look at that if you're going to try to understand his apparent commitment to having WMD, having weapons of mass destruction, and why it is in the face of an American attack that he would continue to maintain he had them or be ambiguous about having them when he didn't, that in this case, he made the decision to go to war against Iran, which for him maybe turned out to be a bad decision because he didn't understand just how many people the Iranian government was willing to throw into this war. And it was his chemical weapons that saved him. So here, right there, you can see why it is he would think it was important to have them. Why maybe later on he wouldn't be willing to say, okay, we don't have them when we don't. He was particularly concerned with what Iran would think. Would Iran think he was vulnerable? Maybe then for that reason, he was willing to risk going to war with the United States to maintain the illusion that, well, maybe he did have them.
And it's important to realize, Saddam, like all of us, was not perfectly consistent. And his logic was not necessarily our logic. I mean, we spent obviously a lot of time debriefing him afterwards, and to understand the regime, we had to understand Saddam. But a couple of your points are exactly right. Mm-hmm. He created, in a sense, deliberately ambiguity, after the year 2000, about his capacity. He wanted, on the one hand, the Security Council members to be convinced that he had more or less complied with the UN resolutions. At the same time, the historic enemy of Iraq over millennia, really, are the Persians, Iran, and he knew that Iran certainly had WMD capacities, including working on nuclear programs. And he felt it was important as a matter of prestige and security to deter them. The other point is also correct that you make, David. In his experience, WMD saved him in the war in the 80s with Iran. I mean, if he didn't have these chemical weapons and he didn't use them in such large numbers, the Iranians would have been taking a lot of territory from Iraq. But interestingly, and it surprised me because they revealed this to me in a conversation in 1995 with some of their ministers, and we hadn't been aware of that before, that in the war with Kuwait, Saddam ordered his forces to load chemical and biological agent into missile warheads, bombs, and artillery rockets. He ordered them to disperse these weapons, and he pre-delegated the authority to use them should the American forces proceed on to Baghdad. From Saddam's perspective, and his top people around him, they are convinced that that action deterred, that's what prevented the Americans from going to Baghdad in 1991. They were convinced that WMD saved them again in the war in 1991. So, that shapes the way Saddam viewed WMD and the world. It also shaped the way American intelligence analysts looked at Baghdad. I mean, in a sense, American intelligence analysts would say, well, Saddam would be crazy not to have WMD. So with that as your hypothesis, the analysts and the collectors were looking at data which supported the assumption that he would have WMD, and they tended to ignore the data which showed that perhaps he didn't.
Well, that, and I think that there, again, we were talking about the misunderstandings, important misunderstandings on both sides, or mindsets that both sides had, that one of the problems we had on our side was that we looked at Saddam Hussein, we looked at his past behavior, we looked at his motivation as best as we could understand, and we said, no way is this guy going to give up his weapons of mass destruction. And if he tells us that he will or tells us that he has, well, we're not going to believe him because we don't think that he would do that.
And, David, there was a track record of him lying to the UN. I mean, our inspection teams were going into Iraq from 1991 until 1998. And for the first several years, the guidance that Saddam gave to his people was give them the obvious things. Give them the missiles and chemical weapons that we know they know about. They'll get tired of poking around and eventually they'll go away. Saddam's objective was to get out of sanctions, to be able to sell his oil freely and import and do business as he wanted. And he was, coached in this approach by some members of the Security Council, especially the Russians. But his view was that he wouldn't have to give up everything. He didn't understand that the resolution, which said you got to get rid of everything, meant everything, and it was categorical. It's sort of a difference in background. But eventually, and we did not know because of this long pattern of lying, but eventually he did get rid of pretty much everything. Now, one of the interesting differences here in perspective is, they, and I use that term to mean, whatever country we're trying to understand, they usually think that the United States is smart. They think we know everything. So, for example, in 1998, the Iraqis were convinced that the United States, with the great CIA and all its satellites and all this collections, must know that, in fact, they had gotten rid of their WMD. And so what we were trying to do was invent reasons to keep the sanctions on. We were inventing evidence, planting the gun, to put it into, police jargon, to cause Saddam to still be guilty, and therefore that the Security Council would keep sanctions on Iraq. Bear in mind that it has always been the policy of the United States that Iraq must comply with the UN sanctions, but also that Saddam must be contained. And this was a paradoxical policy on the United States part. And if you're Saddam, he'd ask me and others, I mean, the Iraqis, that, hey, if we really comply, will Washington agree to lift the sanctions? And he never got a straight answer on that because, of course, the answer was that the United States didn't want him to be without sanctions. Hmm.
And that there is key as well, because the Iraqis came to believe that it didn't matter what they did, that the sanctions wouldn't be lifted. So they figured, well, we might as well go ahead and do what we choose to do, because it really doesn't make any difference what we do.
Yeah. And in 1998, which turns out to be a sort of a critical year, these UN inspections had been going on for 7 years. There'd been a lot of controversy. We'd had a lot of confrontations with the Iraqis trying to go into palaces and this and that. And, it's important to remember context in these things. And I happened to be in Baghdad in, I guess it was January, early February of 1998, when the Monica Lewinsky scandal broke. Now, you would ask yourself, well, what on earth would Monica Lewinsky have to do with, the Iraq crisis in Iraq WMD? Well, the Iraqis, if they didn't understand this, they would be asking me. I thought I was going to be talking about weapons of mass destruction or something. And all these guys wanted to talk about was Monica Lewinsky. They didn't get it. How could the last superpower, be tied up in knots over a 20-something intern? They didn't understand how that worked. I mean, they had a lot of trouble understanding Washington. What they did understand, however, was weakness. They could smell that, like blood in the water in a shark. They understood that Washington was tied up and distracted, and that caused them to make some decisions about how much longer and how much effort they would put into cooperating with the UN. And at the end of 1998, coincidentally with the period of time when President Clinton was being faced with a hearing and impeachment and so forth, they ceased their cooperation. And the United States, in response, bombed for 4 days, which was a very from Iraq's perspective, they don't mind a few bombs. They can rebuild buildings very easily. And one of the Iraqi ambassador, somebody I knew very well, he said to me afterwards, he said, if we had known that was all you were going to do, we would have thrown you guys out a long time ago.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Charles Delfer. He spent over 25 years in the national security agencies of the U.S. government. Most recently, he was the top CIA officer directing the investigation of Saddam Hussein's regime and its WMD programs. He was special advisor to the Director of Central Intelligence for Iraq, WMD. He led the Iraq Survey Group that conducted the investigation of the scope of Iraq's WMD. The report that they issued in the fall of 2004 is generally known as the Delfer Report, and also then in the 90s, he was at the UN serving as the Deputy Executive Chairman and subsequently Acting Chairman of the UN Special Commission on Iraq. That was from 93 until 2000. And is the author of a book that came out earlier in the year, in February. The title of his book is Hide and Seek, The Search for Truth in Iraq. It is published by Public Affairs Books. One of the things that also, again, I guess is kind of surprising about the Iraqis is that it seems that after everything that happened, after the invasion of Kuwait, I think even after 9/11, that the government of Iraq still thought that the United States would believe that Iraq was important to them, could help them with their policy in the Middle East, was a friend. They just didn't get how it was that the United States didn't see that.
Well, that's right. I mean, Saddam, again, he had a good sense of power and relationships, and from his perspective, looking at his region of the world, he concluded, and it's understandable, that the United States really had shared interests with Iraq. I mean, Iraq was secular. They had, and many of their top engineers and technocrats and economists had all been educated in the West. They were great builders. They had a strong army. They were the natural barrier to the Iranians under the clerics and the mullahs there. He saw that, okay, maybe Washington is still sore about our having invaded Kuwait. And maybe that was a miscalculation, but he felt with the passage of enough time, the United States would get over it. They kept passing messages to me and others saying, look, you know, we'll be your best friend in the region, bar none. We'll help you with terrorism. We'll help you with the Middle East peace process. If you need us to work with the Palestinians, you know, you tell us what you need. We'll do whatever you want. Just talk with us. And what they did not understand was, again, it was from their perspective, irrational, but they did not understand that no one in Washington could afford to be seen as dealing with Saddam. I mean, Saddam was seen as just, you know, having no redeeming qualities, and you know, no one could touch him. That would be political suicide in Washington. This was something which, you know, I could have that conversation with Tariq Aziz, Saddam's deputy prime minister, and perhaps the best known public face to the West, and some of his other top people. And, you know, but I'm not sure that they could then pass the message back to Saddam saying, look, Washington, you know, they don't mind Iraq so much, but it's you that they have a problem with. That was part of his you know, his inability to see the world from the Washington perspective.
We are just a little bit past our midpoint here. I have some callers. We'd like to try to get in as many as we can, so please, we hope that people would be brief in their comments. We'll start in here with someone on a cell phone around Bloomington here, line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I do think this whole thing was a smokescreen. I don't believe one bit that we went in there for the purposes we said we did. And I think a lot of people are starting to find out things. I mean, Cheney has something to do with it. I'm not a Republican by no means, just so people don't think I'm labeling so-called people. But I do believe there were ulterior motives. We'll probably find out 50 years from now. But the sad fact is we've lost countless American lives and innocent civilians over there to do a job that we end up probably no different than the Vietnam War. And we have the best military in the world, but yet we seem to don't get it right in the last couple of wars. If we ever have to go to World War III, I really believe that we're going to be taken over, because the lack of information, all the things, hiding things, just, I mean, I don't understand why the American people don't press this issue more. I mean, to me it rates right up there with the economy. I think there's something. We don't need any more weapons to begin with. I think we've developed things that we cannot handle. But at the same time, I have to find out why our intelligence committee and all these other people that have to do with that do what they do. It just doesn't. It boggles the mind. I don't know. I've read a lot of stuff on doing research, and I just don't understand it. But what you're telling me. I think pretty much most people know we were in bed with Saddam from the get-go to fight the Iran war. But at the same time, we hung a guy that was on our side, and we kind of went back on him. So I think the rest of the world takes note of this and says, we're not going to deal with the United States anymore because of the way we act. Is that true?
Well, there's a lot there. I don't know how you would like to respond.
Well, I mean, much of what the caller says is completely understandable. Let me just make a couple of points. Mm-hmm. One, the policy of the United States had been to contain Saddam. That was both under Clinton and Bush, both Bushes. By the time, you know, 9/11 happened, the sanctions were crumbling around Saddam. You know, he was making a lot of money and doing a lot of business under the so-called oil for food program. You know, it was not going to be long before Saddam was, you know, back doing whatever it was he wanted to do. Now, whether that was acceptable or unacceptable is a judgment. But after 9/11, I think President Bush, you know, took the position that, look, we as a country cannot afford to give up the first punch anymore. You know, technology and things had been gotten too risky. So when he looked at Iraq, I don't want to put words in the president's mouth, but he just concluded that that was a risk that, as president, he could not accept, so he wanted to do something about it. And, you know, unfortunately, I conclude, and I think I probably share a view I suspect the caller was expressing, is, you know, we as a country, you know, we're very clumsy. you know, we've got all these, we've got a wonderful military, we've got wonderful, you know, weapons and things, but we can't do brain surgery. And, you know, looking backwards on this whole series of events, what we were seeking to do was to remove the brains of Iraq, change the leadership, and leave the rest of it intact. But we didn't have the sophisticated understanding of Iraq, at least not at the political level, to do that. So, you know, my conclusion would be, you know, or advice for, you know, the current administration or any future administration, that if you decide to do something, you better want to do it very, very badly, because the odds are, as a country, as a government, not a country, but, you know, we will do it very, very badly.
And you, and just to be clear here, what you're saying is that, and I'm not saying that we should have, you know, I'm going to take a position whether we should or shouldn't have gotten rid of Saddam Hussein, but what we could theoretically have done would have been, if we had the right sort of contacts, would be to go to people that were maybe, you know, the middle managers of the Iraqi government and said to them, look, what we want is Saddam and his immediate circle gone. If we can make that happen, if you guys can just hold on, keep the country running, you know, then we'll sort things out. But that, for perhaps for a variety of reasons, it's just not something that we knew how to do or could do. So we had to take the sledgehammer approach, as opposed to the more fine-tuned approach.
David, I think I agree with you, and in fact, I was working, you know, at the time on exactly that approach, where the goal would be to remove Saddam and his top two or three dozen people, and that was the message of, you know, senior Iraqis believed in and supported, you know, including their security services and army and top people in their administration, in their ministries. And I think that could have been very successful. But at a certain point, the politicians in Washington decided that they wanted to get rid of every vestige of the government, and they turned the entire Iraqi army into our enemies. They said all of the Ba'athists, which was the single party in Iraq, and if you wanted to be an engineer or something, the odds were you had to be a Ba'athist in some fashion, much like in the former Soviet Union, you had to be a communist. They declared that all of those things had to go. So anyone who had a any kind of a stake in that became our enemy. This was as a result of the support that the administration was giving to these external opposition groups, and they, you know, elected not to understand or believe the sources that we had inside Iraq at the time. I mean, my conclusion is we could have done this much easier, much less bloodshed, had we sustained that approach. But that approach was blocked by the White House.
All right, we'll go to another caller here, Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Yeah, well, I don't know where to begin, actually. You know, the U.S. installed Saddam so many years ago when we wanted a compliant regime, and he was typically compliant for quite a while. And, you know, we owe a great responsibility for that amongst all the other realpolitik in the Persian Gulf. Kissinger's famous quote about how when we were manipulating the Kurds in the early 70s and cut them loose, that covert action shouldn't be confused with missionary work. The cynicism is revolting, and it's hard to summarize it. But you were contemporaneous with Scott Ritter, who was a gray cloth Republican, I suspect, similar to you. But he says that he knew that there was no substantiation of the allegation, and that basically what the previous caller pointed at is that they wanted to get their war on, and the pretext of 9/11. So. I don't know how you'll react to that, because I know that Ritter's been maligned in a variety of ways through the years, and I'm just curious how you would react to his all of the work that he did for so many years before and after ONSCOM, trying to say that there wasn't a good pretext for it, and it had to have been manipulated, and that's what we've got, and hopefully it'll unfold. But
Well, let's give the guests a chance to respond. Mr. Delfer?
Well, Scott Ritter, I've worked very closely with Scott Ritter for many years at UNSCOM, as the Corps, you know, has mentioned, and he did great work at UNSCOM and was one of our most energetic inspectors and certainly very aggressive in trying to attack the Iraqi system of you know, blocking our inspections. He resigned in 1998 from the UN inspection teams because he did not feel that the Clinton administration was providing adequate support to the inspectors so that we couldn't do our job. This, again, was in the context of Monica Lewinsky and all this. And, you know, for a while he was quite vehement in his accusations about the noncompliance of Iraq. He subsequently came to a different conclusion that Iraq was, you know, in fact, doing things pretty well. And he, you know, made some trips to Iraq and spoke with senior Iraqis and came to this very different conclusion. I don't want to judge him on that, although I would point out I had a lot of conversations about Scott Ritter with the Iraqis after the war, including with their intelligence people, and he seemed to puzzle, you know, them as much as he puzzled me. But I would be cautious about blaming the administration for purposely making mistakes or deceiving the American population. I think they perhaps oversold the concern about WMD, but there was a strong, you know, international pressure that Iraq should be handled by the Bush administration within the UN. Prime Minister Blair of the United Kingdom and Secretary of State Colin Powell in Washington, both were pushing very hard for the president to handle Iraq in the UN context. To do that, it meant, you know, focusing on the WMD question to, you know, the exclusion of all the other things that might have, you know, been risky about the Saddam regime. And that caused everything to turn on evaluations of WMD, which in fact then turned out to be wrong. And so that is a hugely confusing issue. You can ask yourself, you know, legitimately now, I think, you know, wouldn't it have been easier for us to, you know, maintain some kind of relationship with Iraq? We paid a huge price in terms of our knowledge when we broke off relations and removed our embassy staff in 1990 and never returned them. You know, we have the same problem in Iran today, where we lack knowledge, we lack the ability to communicate because we don't have any links or dialogue. Maybe if we had greater understanding in Washington about Iraq, we would have made some different decisions, or we could have manipulated the regime in a less costly way. I don't know. These are all very interesting questions that should be examined.
We just have 10 minutes left, and my lines are full. I really need to go on. I want to try to include some others. Let me just say very quickly, our guest this morning in this hour is Charles Delfer. He was special advisor to the Director of Central Intelligence for Iraq, WMD. He led the Iraq Survey Group that conducted the investigation of the scope of Iraq's WMD, and the report that was issued to the President and Congress in the fall of 2004 is generally known as the Delfer Report. Also, you can read more about his experiences in his book, Hide and Seek, The Search for Truth in Iraq, published earlier this year by Public Affairs. Just very, very quickly, let me ask you this question. On the eve of the invasion of Iraq, what was Iraq's status in regards to WMDs?
Well, it turns out they had no militarily significant stocks. We were wrong on that. Everybody went in wearing gas masks. Our forces, you know, but it was wrong. They did not have any.
When did the United States actually know that? Did we know that on the eve of the invasion?
No, we didn't. I mean, that's why the troops were all outfitted with gas masks and why people were given shots for anthrax. You know, Iraq was not compliant. It did have ballistic missiles, which violated the UN resolutions. But, you know, the immediate threat of biological agent, chemical agent, was not there. And the nuclear program, which had been promoted in many of the press conferences, you know, was virtually non-existent.
All right. Let's go to Urbana next for another caller here. Line 2. Hello.
Hi. You pretty much answered my question earlier. I wanted to ask about Scott Ritter and why his views had been apparently discounted. And I guess you pretty much explained your view anyway. So thanks.
All right. Well, I don't know. If there's nothing further you want to say about Scott Ritter, I can just go on.
No, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but you know, he's an interesting guy.
All right. Let's go to Chicago, line 4. Hello.
Hello. I discovered an interesting historical parallel, and I'm just wondering what you might take from it. The chief architect of the Vietnam War, Robert McNamara, when he resigned from the government, became president of the World Bank, I believe, and I think the chief protagonist of the Iraq War, Paul Wolfowitz, after he left government, also became president of the World Bank. Are we to read anything into this as far as who profits from wars?
Well, I haven't thought of that. It is, I mean, I'm not sure I would, you know, say, you know, I wouldn't blame the World Bank for taking on people that are, you know, promoting wars in the United States. There's a lot of people who, you know, have lost their lives and lost a lot of money and lost, you know, a lot of things in these wars. So, you know, I look more at those who have paid a price.
And let's go to Thomasboro then, line 3. Hello.
Yeah, good morning, David. As gentleman knows, and I was directly involved in this, prior to Desert Storm, the United States deliberately and willfully provided Iraq with all the chemical and biological munitions, including the anthrax from Fort Detrick, Maryland. Two of my buddies sent it there. And then in December 1990, we made the conscious decision to command headquarters, and I was directly involved, to blow up all of this stuff in place, which we began at that time, and then our teams went and finished after the ground war. And then once teams from 108 pulled out, Scott's teams went in. And at that time, I was down at director at Chemical School at Fort McClellan. I trained Scott's teams. And so we knew very, very clearly that Iraq did not have any WMDs, and everybody was involved in that and knew in that, even in the middle of the 90s and then going on. And then in 1995, we began planning the invasion of Iraq, which is now Operation Iraqi Freedom. So it had nothing to do with WMDs. It had nothing to do with 9-1-1, but our original plans, which were scheduled to take off in November of 2000, then got the kibosh put on them when Gore didn't get elected. So a lot of this stuff came about, and it was just devastating, and the health effects on all of the U.S. troops and all of the coalition troops on the Iraqis has just turned into an absolute nightmare. And so I find it just continuously interesting, and I was wondering... since I was directly, I was the Army officer that actually did the intelligence briefing for the command staff prior to the initiation of the ground war, and it was exactly what Iraq possessed. And we knew that they did possess it because the U.S. had given it to them, but we had also made the decision in December 1990 to blow it up. And Schwarzkopf admitted that in page 390 of his autobiography. So I don't know if your guest is familiar with our operations and Bowers Raiders, it'd be interesting in his comments.
No, Mr. Duffer.
Yeah, well, I would take issue with some of the statements of fact that the caller made with respect to what the United States provided to Iraq. Iraq obtained so-called seed stock, that is the initial little bits of anthrax and some of those things from the United States, but that was not by a conscious decision in the United States. In those days when they did that, the controls on those bits were not what they should be. And they did it by surreptitious means. Likewise, the Iraqi chemical weapons infrastructure was largely built from equipment that they were able to get from Europe. The United States export controls in the 80s and 90s were, you know, they weren't as strong as they should have been, but it wasn't from the United States that Iraq was able to construct its large chemical weapons infrastructure. With respect to the assessments about their capabilities before the 1991 war, yes, it was understood that Iraq probably had chemical weapons capability and biological weapons capability. There were sites designated as best intelligence could determine, and those sites were hit, including some of the nuclear sites. They were on the targeting list that CENTCOM under Schwarzkopf had put together. But it was not clear, you know, we did not know precisely what they had. So I guess I would take issue with those points. And on the points during the 90s, you know, we didn't know what Iraq was able to produce from outside sources. I mean, we had a sense of what their capacity was, but we did not know how much more infrastructure they were able to reconstitute For example, we didn't know that they had developed VX until some period of time into the 90s. We did not know, or the Iraqis did not admit that they had a major capacity to produce biological agent until 1995. So, you know, it was a lot of effort to get them to admit some of these things.
Colin, do you want to follow up quickly?
Well, I guess we're just a little bit disagreement from firsthand experience. David, I sent you the Regal Commission report and the list of companies, U.S. companies, provided all that. We've talked about this before. And again, it was very clear that Iraq did have it before. We consciously destroyed it. It was provided us, including the weapons. We actually shipped weapons from Tooele and other things over there, chemical weapons, to Iraq, and they were used. Al-Ajba was U.S. weapons. But now it's all water over the dam. But again, the whole thing is that we had to get Iraq out, and it was all over oil. That's what the plans were originally. That's what the plans are now. And if you go in back up and pull up the original plans and look at it, you'll see it. But anyhow, right now we got a horrendous casualty count, a million casualties plus out of Iraqi freedom and enduring freedom, and it's all over, no reason whatsoever. Anyhow, thank you.
All right. Well, I guess that what I continue to hear from people is their question about why it is we went into Iraq in the first place. I know that you talked a little bit about this earlier in response to another caller, but do you feel that you understand what the motivation of the Bush administration was in making this decision?
I take the president at his word when he just judged after 9/11, after, you know, the United States having been attacked in the context of the events at the time, that he wanted to solve the Iraq problem. He no longer wanted to just contain Iraq. I think every step to implement that was flawed in horrible ways, and I think he was ill served by some of the people around him, particularly in the civilian side of the Pentagon. I think they made decisions based on ignorance and almost willful ignorance, in a sense. I think they were, you know, it's not that they were evil, but that they were, you know, exercising bad judgment and you know, kind of a wishful thinking that they could create a democracy in this piece of geography that we call Iraq. I just think it was terribly, terribly misguided.
We're coming to the point here we have a few minutes left. Back at the beginning, we were talking about the basic problem here being a lack of understanding. Each side thought they knew something about the other. They made assumptions about the other, what they were thinking, and then they made policy based on those assumptions. The assumptions were wrong. The policy was bad. Does it concern you? Do you think that, and I ask the question, no, I think I know what the answer is, that as far as our dealings today with countries like Iran or with North Korea, that we are making the same mistake?
I worry exactly that point. And you know, in Iran, you know, we don't have a deep understanding of it. We know more about Iran than we did about Iraq. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, there's many Iranian Americans who go back and forth. You know, they are on the internet. You know, at Baghdad, there was no satellite TV. There was no internet. At least in Iran, there is some understanding. But we don't have an embassy. There's not a pool of American officials, senior officials, who know the Iranians and can have a tactile feel for the way they view the world. And it's even worse with North Korea. You know, you hear commentators, including government commentators, saying, oh, well, Kim Il-jung, the leader of North Korea, you know, is launching missiles because he wants attention. Well, we don't know that. People are just making this stuff up. We did that with Saddam simply because no one knew any better. So, you know, we don't know what's motivating him. And that can be extremely dangerous because we can make big mistakes. Likewise, I mean, I'm sure Kim Jong-il is clueless about what motivates Washington. And, you know, those are risky misunderstandings when nuclear weapons and things like that are involved.
Well, here, you know, I think that this suggests what has maybe been for a while now a basic problem with our intelligence apparatus, and that is some things we have are very good and they're highly advanced and we can intercept and communications that are out in the open, and we have spy satellites so that we can at least see what there is to be seen. But the problem is in so many of the places that we're concerned about, we don't have people on the ground. And not only do we not have, we don't have covert people, but we also don't have people out in the open. We don't have diplomats. We don't have people who were positioned like you have been in Iraq. People who are actually there, who are trying to meet with representatives of the government of the other side, and sort of get a sense of what's going on. And, you know, maybe in a place like North Korea, that's just impossible, or maybe it's just very difficult.
Well, you're right, David. And when you have very little data, you are still obligated to make an assessment. If you have only 2 points, you draw a line between them. And the assumptions that we make are that other people behave the way we do, that our logic applies there. And this is, it's regularly demonstrated wrong. But when you have no, alternative hypothesis, when you have no idea what the logic is in Pyongyang, then what you're left with is, well, I'm going to assume that they behave like we would behave. Now, that's an assumption you can make, but it's probably going to be wrong. This is a huge problem. And, we're good at collecting technical data. We can send a satellite over, we can take pictures and stuff, but what does that mean? When we were doing inspections in Iraq, we would get these, breathless intelligence reports from Washington. Oh, the Iraqis are doing something wicked in this place. So our inspectors would go there, and almost inevitably, when the inspectors got there, there would be some weird, completely unpredictable, completely Iraqi explanation for what was going on the ground, which, via a satellite transmitted to some computer screen in Washington, looked like something wicked to somebody who, would spend 6 hours a day in front of a computer screen and then went home and rearranged their lawn furniture. And that's as close to Iraq as they ever got.
We'll have to leave it at that. If people would like to read more, you look for the book that I've mentioned. It came out earlier this year. Its title is Hide and Seek, The Search for Truth in Iraq, published by Public Affairs, by our guest, Charles Delfer. He served as the deputy chairman of the UN Weapons Inspection Organization from 1993 until 2000. He was also leader of the Iraq Survey Group, which was the CIA-led team charged with the search for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. His name is commonly given to the final CIA report of the Iraq Survey Group, the Delfer Report. Mr. Delfer, thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you, David, and thank you to your listeners. Mm-hmm.